Saturday, August 6, 2011 in Salt Lake City will be our next live show, and it will be hosted by the lovely Zilpha Larson.
Wait, I thought it was hosted by the fabulous John Larson.
Well, maybe we'll both be there. And this year we're going to shake it up and do something different. This show is mostly a concert. We have five great bands who will be there, including...
That's right. We've got Shane Jackman, McCall Erickson, Kristen Erickson, Otter Creek, that's the Danzigs.
Peter and Mary.
We also have David Jorgensen.
There'll be live commentary and music, and our theme this year is...
Embracing uncertainty. So if you're not sure about if you want to go to the show or not, just embrace the uncertainty and go for it.
Tickets are available now if you go to mormonexpression.com/tickets. You can get your ticket there. The list price is $17. It'll be $22 at the door. But now, for a limited time, you can pay whatever price you think is decent. We have some sponsors who are helping pick up the tab and help pay the musicians and the sound guys and all that sort of stuff.
Yep. So it's a great opportunity to name your own price and go get your ticket.
There are a limited number of seats, and I know a lot of people are planning on coming and sort of putting off buying their tickets, so you want to make sure you get yours early so you can reserve your seat. There will also be some extra special guests showing up, personalities from the podcast and whatnot.
Yep.
And you get a chance to meet the lovely Zilpha Larson and her trollish husband. Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. We're here back with part two. Now, you guys just heard part one just 2 days ago. Did we call you George or Clinton? I can't remember.
We called me George.
Okay. Now, George, how long has it been for us? We recorded that one about 4 weeks ago or so, didn't we?
It's been about that long.
So I apologize to the audience. We might repeat ourselves, but they can suffer. All right. So in the previous episode, we sort of covered Masonry, the history of it, and kind of leading up. And I think we ended up right at the
Morgan affair.
Yeah. We were around about there. So. Now, this one, I want to talk a little bit about, well, I want to talk a lot about Mormonism and Masonry, which I believe is very, very key to understanding early Mormonism and Mormon development and everything up until the Brigham Young period. And I think it is highly misunderstood by both critics and by the faithful.
I think you're exactly right. And I think this is, in many ways... the reason why it's misunderstood is very complicated. One of the largest reasons is because, you know, Masons, the general perception of Freemasonry is we can't talk about anything. And so it's kind of been a feeling amongst many that, oh, well, there's nothing that can be talked about. And that's stymied a lot of really good, productive discussion, I think, and being able to clear out many of these problems.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we hinted in the last hour, we talked about things that, you know, a lot of Mormons would probably feel uncomfortable, but we were talking about them in the auspice of Masonry, you know, so.
Oh, yeah.
So you have that double whammy for Mormons. There's the shroud over Masonry in general. And then, of course, the idea of the sacredness of the temple and what can and can't be spoken about.
Mm-hmm. And I think in the last podcast, we did a very good job of making both sides happy as far as minding the things that maybe we shouldn't talk about, but at the same time, talking about things that we did need to talk about.
Is that where you go? Because I'm usually happy when I make both sides unhappy. That's usually where, that's where I'm aiming for. But, you know, each their own. You can do your own thing.
Okay. Well, I'd like to go ahead and start today with a quote.
Okay.
This quote comes from Stanley Kimball's biography of Heber C. Kimball.
Heber
C. Kimball was one of these, very, very stalwarts in the church. He was also a Freemason before the Morgan Affair and continued his activity of Masonry into Utah. When he died, shortly before he died, one of the things he said was that he was very proud that he'd lived up to his Masonic oaths and covenants his entire life. And in trying to write this portion of his life, Stanley Kimball had a hard time. And he said the following, and this is in 1981. To date, there is no satisfactory study of Mormonism and Masonry. Of the three older standard treatments, S.J. Goodwin's Mormonism and Masonry, Anthony W. Ivan's Relationship of Mormons and Freemasonry, and E. Cecil McGavin's Mormonism and Masonry, the latter is the least vacuous and discursive. Ivins and McGavin knew almost nothing about Masonry, and Goodwin knew even less about Mormonism. And I find it interesting. I had a chance to go to the Mormon History Association. Mormons, statistically, tend to be very, very active in studying Mormon history. There's a lot written about Mormon history.
Mm-hmm.
If you study other religions, there's a lot of them are not as interested in their own history. Now, to back that up, though, the Mormons that are really interested in their history is probably 1%. But we've produced a lot of research, and yet this was 30 years ago. And really today, we're still in the same situation. We still do not have a satisfactory study of Mormon and Masonry.
And, it's really impactful. I bought a book, I think last year I got a Deseret book, that had some really beautiful glossy shots of the stonework on the Salt Lake Temple. Mm-hmm. And there was a description of them, and it was really – and they were good, reputable academics, but it was really quite embarrassing that they were oftentimes missing the overt Masonic history. And I don't know if they intentionally left it out or it's through ignorance or whatever – but it's sort of embarrassing when you look at the book that they wouldn't put that stuff in.
Oh yeah, one of the most beautiful pictures I've got. There's a web page out there that has some beautiful pictures of the Salt Lake Temple, and one of them that's just absolutely gorgeous is the picture of that gorgeous, I think it's bronze, doorknob.
Yes,
a pair of them on the door, and there's this gorgeous beehive, which is, directly modeled on the, it's a Masonic symbol. In fact, right. If you read Brigham Young's description of it, he almost quotes word for word the Masonic ceremony. And in fact, if you actually look to either side of those doors, there is a little alcove on either side of the door, and that used to hold a statue of, on one side, Joseph Smith, and on the right-hand side, I believe it was Hiram Smith. And that is very, very common in old Masonic buildings, that as you walked in, you would see on one side and the other side the two patron statues of the two patron saints of Masonry, which are St. John the Baptist and St. John the Revelator. And so, even these little tiny interesting nuances that were picked up from Masonry are really very, very lost on most people that walk through that building and see that imagery.
Yeah, definitely. And once you're familiar with the symbols, it's really hard to dismiss them because there's an overwhelming number of them. I mean, I can see saying, oh, well, the beehive is just coincidence, because Deseret was mentioned in the Book of Mormon. But they're just all over the place. And they were in the past, you talked about during Heber Kimball's time, they were so open about it that it's this closed mm-hmm. secret now that would be very foreign to those who put the symbols in. They wouldn't have seen it as cryptic.
Well, and there's documented evidence. Brigham Young used to call the endowment ceremony celestial Masonry.
Right.
And if you actually, what's even more interesting is if you actually look on the Salt Lake Temple, if you see a lot of symbols, but if you actually go back to the old plans, there are even more. In fact, there's actually was planned around a whole set of windows, was there was actually supposed to be a square and compass around both around all of these windows. And in the end, that was not decided on. That was not done for cost purposes, as well as they were trying to get away from that imagery, I think, in part.
Well, now, the Star of David is all over there. How much of that is an overlay or intended as a reference to the square and compass?
One of the things to consider here is actually the Star of David itself appears in a lot of Masonic art. Now, obviously, it's a borrowed symbol, but, you know, it's a common symbol. Maybe not as common as the square and compass, but there are definitely, you know, people who have looked at that square and compass and said, oh, you know, this is an implied meaning of the Star of David. I think that's a little bit more implied than reality in history. And I haven't been able to find a whole lot of references in Joseph Smith's time period that those two were connected. But there probably is a little bit of literature at that period of time.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning of now Mormonism and Masonry. And you said you wanted to start in Vermont?
Yeah. Before we go there, can I go ahead and talk a little bit more about that quote that we dealt with?
Sure, yeah.
One of the reasons why it's been difficult to really have a good history of Mormonism and Masonry is the one that Kimball actually points out. And that is, on the one side, you have the Mormons who know absolutely nothing about Masonry. And on the other side, you have Masons, for the most part, who knew nothing about Mormonism. And each of the traditions has a very, very distinct and complex vocabulary, and as well as a history. And you really have to know both of those in very, very great detail to pick out the nuances and to really understand what's going on. And I think that's been a lot of the problem. Now, there have been a couple of researchers who have been Mormons and Masons, and I want to go ahead and mention them. One of them is a guy by the name of Nick Letursky, who was living in Nauvoo for years, and he's done a vast amount of research that has not yet been published. But I've kept in contact with him, and we've talked quite a bit. The other person is a guy by the name of Joe Steve Swick, the third, I should say, who is also a Mormon and a Mason, and he's done some research as well, but none of that has been published. And so, you know, it's been difficult to actually get, I think, the qualifications and the expertise in the Mormon historical field to actually head-on hit this subject. And although, you know, we can kind of joke and say, oh, nobody wants to do it, or, you know, they're trying to avoid it, I think there is some legitimacy that they just don't have the expertise to really handle the material well.
Well, I think on that note, just because you're one or the other or both doesn't mean you understand them. I mean, you can be a practicing Latter-day Saint and not have a really good understanding or grasp of the church doctrine or history. The same with Masonry. So you not only have to be empathetic to both of them, you have to understand them, and merely participating is not enough to get that understanding.
Amen. Because I've actually had some conversations with Mormon Masons, and there's really not that many of us. But there's been a few that I've had conversations with, and you know, they'll hear what I'm saying. They're saying, I've never heard that. I have no idea what you're talking about. And there's problems here because, as you said, there's lots of Mormons who really don't know their history. And in order to really understand what's going on, you have to, in the Mormon field, you really have to understand intimate details and complex details of, you know, what's going on in Vermont. All of Joseph Smith's treasure seeking and those type of things that are going on in New York, you have to know complex things and development that's going on in Kirtland. You have to understand the Mormon War and what's going on in Missouri. And when you get to the Nauvoo period, there is so much stuff that you have to understand of Mormon history in order to even glean and figure out what Joseph Smith's doing with the Masonic symbols. And the same is true with the Masonic side. You know, you can be a expert on British Freemasonry, but that doesn't help you. In fact, you really have to be an expert in the Masonic field on about the dates of 1790 to about 1870. So you have to be an expert on the dates from about 1790 to about 1870. And you have to really understand that time period. Now, the sad thing is, at least on the Masonic side, there's very few even Masonic scholars who are well-versed in that time period, in a large part because that's right exactly the time that the Morgan Affair happens. And Masons are a little squeamish about really digging into the history there because, you know, it's hard not to run into things and say, ooh, they made a mistake.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Now we covered the Morgan Affair in rather deep detail last time, right?
Yes, we did.
So now are we ready to delve into Vermont?
Let's go to Vermont. So one of the things that as I began to research this, I wanted to understand very complex details about what was going on in Masonry and what Masonry looked like in these early years. And so one of the first things I did was, since really Joseph Smith and his family, you know, Mormonism in many ways begins in Vermont. We usually think about it as in New York, but it really begins in Vermont. And so I began to study the history of Vermont Masonry. And I'm just going to kind of give you a real quick rundown of some major stats. And if there's any words or things here that I use that are unfamiliar, go ahead and call me on those and I'll explain them.
Okay.
So the Grand Lodge of Vermont is formed in 1794. And by 1803, there are about 20 lodges in Vermont. And 1803 is, you know, really getting into Joseph Smith's time period there, or at least Joseph Smith Sr.'s time period there. Vermont Lodge number one, there's three lodges very close to Joseph Smith's home. One is Vermont Lodge number one, Center Lodge number six, which is in Rutland, and Federal Lodge number 15 in Randolph. And that Federal Lodge is going to become really important in just a moment. From 1803 to 1807, Blue Lodge Masonry is growing very quickly, and there's seven lodges added to the rolls of the Grand Lodge. The interesting thing here is that three of those seven, so almost 50% of them, are within a 25-mile radius of Charron, Joseph Smith's birthplace. There's a new lodge organized in 1804 called Warren Lodge in Woodstock. In the same year, there's another lodge in Chelsea organized called George Washington Lodge number 24, and then Rising Star Lodge number 28 in Royalton is organized in 1807. And so one of the things I first, as I was studying this, was somewhat surprised that, you know, some of the largest growth of Freemasonry is going on within a 20-mile radius of Joseph Smith, or 25-mile radius of Joseph Smith's house. And so one of my parts of the research I wanted to do was to figure out why that was happening. And I'm going to tell you that story in just a little bit. any questions about what's going on there?
I'm good so far.
Okay. Have we gone over the difference between a Grand Lodge and a regular lodge and the kind of hierarchy that works there?
It might be worth to review.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that because actually to Mormonism, it actually plays a very, very important part that I think has been missed by many people. So if we're to compare this in Mormonism in Joseph Smith's day, there were really only two units in which the church was divided. You had the stakes, and you had either the wards or the branches. Each of those stakes was, for the most part, completely and totally independent. And they would oversee a number of branches or wards. Now, obviously, that's very different than the way things work today. The other thing that's important to realize here is to look at the organization of those wards and branches. They were most usually organized in kind of threesomes. You'd have the, and that's still true today, you'd have the president and then his first and second counselor, and you'd also usually have a secretary and a treasurer. If we look at masonry, and this is potentially somewhat coincidental, but I don't think it's fully coincidental, you have a similar structure. You have lodges, which are, there's many lodges, but in order to form, they need the permission of what's known as the Grand Lodge. And so, at least in Mormon terms, if I say Grand Lodge, think of the stake. And if I say just regular lodge, think of a ward. The other thing that's interesting here is you have the same trifecta organization. Whether you're talking about the lodge level or the Grand Lodge level, the officers in the lodge, the one that runs the lodge is called the Worshipful Master, which is similar to, you know, like a bishop. And then you have the senior and junior wardens, which are the first and second counselor, if we're to compare. And then below that, you have the senior and junior deacons, which help out in the lodge. And so there is, to some extent, some parallels that can be drawn here between how Joseph Smith is organizing the church and how the Masonic units themselves are organized. Now, this is somewhat of a vague parallel, but as we'll go into later, Joseph Smith was reading Masonic literature that suggested that the church itself in antiquity was modeled in its structure, its ecclesiastical structure and its organizational structure on masonry. So it's very probable that, at least in Joseph Smith's head, there was some desire to mimic this structure.
Makes sense to me. I mean, you have to look at things in terms of probability. And, you know, what's the probability that these two structures were completely self-formed, independent, without any cross-fertilization? But, yeah. You know, I don't, to me, and I think I mentioned this in the first version, in our first episode, I don't think that necessarily speaks to the truth value of the church, because, you know, God or Joseph Smith or whoever can very well look at what's around them and take those pieces into the culture. So I don't think people should be scared of that sort of information.
No, I don't think they should either. But I think it also helps us to potentially understand what's going through Joseph Smith's head.
Definitely.
A little bit more. Now, the other thing that I find interesting here is that there's another organization in Masonry known as the Royal Arch or the York Rite. And it's somewhat ambiguous what the role there is. You know, is the York Rite is considered to be higher degrees, or the Royal Arch is considered to be higher degrees than the first three degrees. But the, you know, kind of who's in charge is somewhat ambiguous. The interesting thing there is that in the literature Joseph Smith was reading, the leadership of the Royal Arch was made up of three principal actors: the prophet, the priest, and the king.
Right.
And so if you actually look at the church itself, you get kind of the same type of thing. For the most part, the stakes at this time period were somewhat autonomous. Joseph Smith was in charge, but, you know, with his first presidency, which didn't always just have two counselors. But, you know, he kind of seems to be the moral and revelatory leader of the church, but not always fully in control of the day-to-day activities of the stake. And in many ways, sometimes they could veto him. And so you have this same type of, a little bit of an ambiguity there. So back to Vermont history, there was also these Royal Arch lodges, or Royal Arch chapters, as they're called. There were three, a fair ways away. There was one in Rutland, one in Granville, and one in Pulteney, and those were known as Grand Master Lodges. And then in 1805, the Grand Chapter of Vermont was formed in Rutland. And Rutland is, a fair distance away from where Joseph Smith lived, but it's not that far. And in fact, Masons would have probably traveled to that area in order to get their Royal Arch degree. Now, the interesting thing, I think, is, remember I mentioned that there was this Federal Lodge number 15 in Randolph.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that if you look at their records, that three of Joseph Smith Jr.'s uncles were members of Federal Lodge number 15. One of them is John C. Waller, who married Joseph Smith's senior sister, Priscilla, in 1796. And he actually was very active in the lodge. He actually served as the senior warden of Federal Lodge number 15 in Randolph in 1804. And so basically the second-hand man, basically the first counselor in that lodge. And so, very, very active. The other two members of the lodge are Aziel Smith, I really can't trace him to Federal Lodge number 15, but there's a lodge near there called Green Mountain Lodge number 37, which in 1812 lists as their junior warden, or sorry, in 1817 lists as their junior warden, Aziel Smith. Now, Aziel was interesting. He later would move to New York, and when Joseph Smith Sr. would come to visit in 1830, right after the Book of Mormon was published, he tried to convert his brothers. Aziel joined the church, moved to Kirtland, was immediately ordained a high priest and a member of the Kirtland High Council. He then, as the church moved, he ended up in Iowa, where he served the stake high counselor. He was later ordained as the patriarch of the church in October 1844, and then he died en route to the West. The other brother, Joseph Smith Sr.'s brother, was affectionately usually known as Uncle John, probably joined Federal Lodge number 15. And then when he moved to New York, he joined a lodge there as well. Now, John Smith, I think often we forget about all these people that are on the somewhat periphery of Mormonism during this time period, but John Smith is extremely important. He also joins the church when Joseph Smith Sr. comes to visit. He moves to Kirtland in 1833. He's immediately ordained a high priest. He becomes a member of the First High Council. He participates in Zion's camp. He's one of these people that signs the petition to warn out the justice of the peace in Kirtland. He's a member. He's actually made a member of the First Presidency in 1837. He serves on the High Council, which excommunicates a number of people. He signs the petition to kick out David Whitmer, John Whitmer, Lyman E. Johnson, and W.W. Phelps out of the Missouri area. He's very, very active in the Danite movement in 1843. He's plurally married to a second wife. He joins the Anointed Quorum. He's a member of the Council of 50. And actually, he continues, goes all the way to Utah. And while Brigham Young is out of town from 1847 to 1848, he actually acts basically as the president of the church for that time period. And in 1848, he's officially called as the patriarch of the whole church. And so, these men are very, very active in the church. They are very, very close to Joseph this entire time. And these are men who were Freemasons, were interested in Freemasonry, and it's just undoubtable that they would have had an influence on Joseph and, discussed probably Masonic ideas and theories with him.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. He was in this soup, and the idea that he wasn't influenced by ideas around him would be absurd.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this isn't just a man who, you know, later in 1842 joins Masonry. He's born into a Masonic family. Masonry is a family tradition in the Smith home. And I think that's often forgotten. You know, we definitely have these uncles that are Masons themselves. And then when we get into the New York period, we're going to find that the family connections become even more tight. So in my research, what I wanted to do was look to see what Freemasonry in Vermont looked like. You know, what was being discussed in the lodges. And so what I did was I actually went through the Grand Lodge records from Vermont, which are published. And I began to, and I never finished the project, sadly enough, copy down all of the names of the leadership in each of the lodges surrounding Joseph Smith. And then to do a little bit of biographical research on each and every single one of them. Now, I didn't get to all of them. In fact, I didn't even get all of them mapped out. But in my research, I found one that when I saw the name, I got very, very excited. And that was Hosea Ballyhoo, who was the worshipful master in one of the lodges in the surrounding area. Now, I don't know if you ever heard of the name Hosea Ballyhoo.
No, I haven't. At least not that I can remember.
You're going to love this story. To get into this story, I'm going to ask you a question. You probably, well, I don't know. A lot of people don't realize this. Do you know what Joseph Smith's paternal grandfather's religion was?
No, I don't.
No, that's okay. Joseph Smith's paternal grandfather was a Universalist, as in Universalist Unitarians.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived, they were living, well, when he, before he moved to Vermont, he lived about 15 miles away from, I believe it's John Murray, and I may have the name wrong there. And he was the kind of first real preacher in America of the Universalist doctrine. And so he's usually referred to as the grandfather of Universalism in America. And after hearing what he had to say, he ended up moving to Vermont in 1797, Aziel Smith, who is Joseph Smith's grandfather, with his two sons, Jesse Smith and Joseph Smith Sr., organized a Universalist society in Turnbridge, Vermont. And so there's this tradition within the family of, you know, being members of the church. And we know that Aziel was very, very interested in Universalism. He, you know, started his own society of it. George A. Smith, his grandson, says that not long before his death, he wrote many quires of paper on the doctrines of universal salvation. And we actually have some of those. And so he basically went to his grave very, very interested in the Universalist doctrine. Now, Joseph Smith Sr. also is a member who is on that document. And George A. Smith had this to say about Joseph Smith Sr. He says, he said that the only son that followed in his father's footsteps, in Aziel Smith's footsteps, was Joseph Smith Sr. And William Smith, Joseph Smith Sr.'s son, said, "My father's religious habits were strictly pious and moral. His faith was in universal restoration doctrine, which often brought him into contact with advocates of the doctrine of endless misery." And so the interesting thing here is you've got Aziel Smith, Joseph Smith's grandfather, and his father, who are, you know, very, very interested in the Universalist movement and doctrine. The reason I bring this up is because while John Murray is considered to be the grandfather of the Universalist movement in America, The father of universalist movement is Hosea Ballou. And he lives 8-10 miles away from the Smith family home. He wrote a book called the The Treatise on the Atonement, which most historians actually consider it like the Bible of Universalism. In this time period, if you were a Universalist, you had in one hand your Bible, and you had in the other hand Hosea Ballou's book. And it was written in, 10 miles away from the Joseph Smith's house. And, being Universalist, it's very, very likely that they would have attended meetings and heard Hosea Ballou speak.
Okay, well, I mean, I can buy the Universalist connection because the Book of Mormon comes out so anti-Universalist.
Dan Vogel has written a number of things about that. The funny thing that I find is I'm not so sure that that interpretation is perfect. Because if you actually look statistically at the early church members, the people that joined the church early, as it turns out, there's an inordinately high percentages of Universalists that join the church. And so at least for them, when they read the Book of Mormon, they weren't seeing a Universalist, an anti-Universalist sentiment within the Book of Mormon. Or maybe they were, and that's why they joined. But if you want to read that type of interpretation into it, if anything, he's really giving a very, very weak argument against Universalism. And so I'm not so sure that at least everyone would have seen the Book of Mormon itself as anti-Universalist.
Well, I don't see it as an out-and-out attack on Universalism, but, as it's been written about quite extensively, the time period, Americans were unchurched. They were very religious, but they weren't really into religion as much. So things like the book Mormonism was sort of a reaction against that. So Universalists don't have real strong need to go to church other than for social reasons. So if you really want people to go to church and pay tithing and stuff, you sort of have to put forth an argument against that pattern.
Agreed. So one of the interesting things here I find is that actually if you look at the Universalist movement during that time period, and I'm going to go into this some different points here, it wasn't like Universalism today. It was a very, very Christian organization. They were very, very devout into reading. They were very much Christ-centered, which today, and maybe I'm wrong, the Universalist Unitarians are not so much that. They're much more open and willing to look at anybody's interest.
Right.
But anyways, so I started doing some research on Hosea Ballou. He preached at Barnard, Vermont, surrounding towns in 1801. And I've actually tracked his preaching route. And he like rings the Smith family house. He was moving from one area to the other. And it turns out he was a extremely, extremely active Mason. He gave a number of orations at the lodges. He became a worshipful master of the lodge. When he moves later in 1811 to 1815, he moves to New Hampshire. He's actually the junior warden of the Grand Lodge. In Boston, he serves and joins Mount Lebanon Lodge, and he's one of the founding members of St. Paul's Royal Arch Chapter, which gets founded in 1818. His historians that have studied Hosea Ballou say that significantly the only one non-church activity to which he consistently devoted himself was Freemasonry, a social and charitable movement that embodied universal principles. And as you begin to study Freemasonry, one of the things that's interesting is that statistically, because Universalist churches were not that common, but Freemasonry is loaded with Universalists. And so there's this a disproportionate number of Universalists within Freemasonry. So what it looks like is that Hosea Ballew moves into the area while he's making his circuit preaching. He's probably stopping into all the lodges. He's such a great speaker that he and advocate of Freemasonry and its growth that he is, in fact, probably one of the driving forces behind the expansion of Freemasonry in the area. And, you know, Joseph Smith's brothers are interacting with him, most likely. Now, the other thing that I want to bring up is actually, if you look at the treatise that he wrote, he has another, you know, obviously Joseph Smith in his later period in the Kirtland, he adopts very much a Universalist idea. If you look at the three degrees of glory, they are very definitely, you know, modeled to some extent on, not the three degrees of glory, but, you know, the fact that everyone is saved. And, you know, that the eternal punishment that's described in the scriptures is no longer described as eternal. It's described as God's punishment, and that eternal is really code word for God. And right. So, you know, Joseph, really this Universalist idea seeps into and becomes part of Mormonism from Kirtland on.
Okay, so obviously Mormonism born into a soup of Freemasonry. I guess the next thing is the Book of Mormon.
Okay, well, hold on. I'm gonna jump with one thing really quickly.
Okay.
Quickly here. So I started reading heavily into the Treatise of Atonement, on the Atonement that Hosea Ballew wrote. And the interesting thing here is that it's also not Hosea Ballew was not a Trinitarian. He was actually, well, his views are interesting. There's this section in the Treatise of Atonement where he talks about the basically there's this long diatribe of him making fun of the doctrine of the Trinity that sounds almost like it came right out of the temple ceremony. And then he continues on, and he then has to define what Universalist doctrine is concerning the Trinity. And that, believe it or not, this is going to come back to Masonry pretty quick here. He starts quoting all of these scriptures describing the relationship between God and Jesus. And basically one of the things he says is that Jesus is separate from God, but then he describes the path in which Jesus himself becomes a God. And it's very fascinating because the scriptures he chooses are scriptures that to Masons would have resonated quite a bit. He talks about how they will become pillars in the temple of God. He talks about them riding upon him, that in order to become God, Jesus had his name written upon, that God's name written upon him. He says, I will write upon him a new name. He talks about Jesus becoming God because he was anointed with oil, and then that he was placed on a throne. And, you know, these type of imagery of, you know, anointing new names and those type of things. Now, I actually was able to get a whole series of orations by Hosea Ballew that he was giving in the lodges at this time period. And the interesting thing here is that he's using Masonic ideas and philosophy actually as proof text of his Universalist ideas. Not only that, he is intimately interpreting the Masonic ceremony as a allegory of Jesus's anointing and receiving a new name, and etc. All these things are connected with Masonry, and he's putting them. He's basically describing the entire Masonic ceremony as an allegory of becoming like God. And there's this whole series of this. So there's this trend within Jose Ballyhoo that he is actually linking his Freemasonry and his religion as one. And as it turns out, if you actually look during this time period, you find that everyone was doing this. One of the most popular authors at the time was a guy by the name of Salem Town, and he published a book where he interprets all of the Masonic rituals as a Christian allegory, talking about passing through the veil and receiving a new name and being anointed and placed on a throne. And so there's this trend within Freemasonry at the time to treat it as a Christian discussion and to interpret the meaning of this ritual in exactly the same way that Joseph would later do in Nauvoo.
Interesting. So I guess that didn't stick anywhere else besides Mormonism.
You know, after the Morgan affair, a lot of them backed away from that type of a stance, because it's actually one of the things that angered a lot of the preachers, because they actually felt like all of a sudden Masonry was encroaching upon their own turf. And so after the Morgan affair, they started backing away from that. And so, yeah, it really doesn't stick anywhere but Mormonism. If you go into a lodge today, you won't hear that type of discussion.
Well, and I would assume that, I don't know how overt it is, but there is at least a tacit knowledge that the Mormons have sort of picked it up and run with it. So I would think that people want to avoid it to not be associated with Mormonism.
Right. Now, just as kind of an example of this, I want to give you one real quick here. And I want to talk about a certain degree that most people are unfamiliar with. This is Salem Town's description of a degree which is called the Order of High Priesthood. And he interprets the ritual in this way. There he beholds in the eighth degree that all the heavenly sojourners will be admitted within the veil of God's presence, where they will become kings and priests before the throne of glory forever and ever, having been consecrated by the blood shed for the remission of sins, born of the Spirit and anointed with the oil of the divine grace, having on the robe of righteousness and the breastplate of salvation, he doubts not but a crown of glory, rejoicing, will be put on his head, and the praises of the Redeemer forever dwell on his tongue. So you can see this type of Christianization of the interpretation of the ritual. Now, this Order of High Priesthood ritual is fascinating and is directly connected to Masonry. This Order of High Priesthood degree is one that is used to put in, to basically set up a person for running the Royal Arch Lodge. And in order to get this degree, one has to be first a prophet, then a priest, and then a king in the European system. In America, you have to become first a prophet or a scribe, then you become a king, and then you become a priest. The order is flipped there. And in this ritual, you actually play the role of Abraham as he comes to visit Melchizedek. And the interesting thing here is, in one portion of the ritual, they bring you into, you pass the veil, going into the tent of Melchizedek. You then eat bread and wine, which the ritual itself tells you is connected with the sacrament. And then you are anointed with oil and wine. And in fact, there are two other rituals within the Scottish Rite where that happens as well. Now, the interesting thing here is the Order of High Priesthood has several names. When it was very first started, it was called the Order of Melchizedek. It was then changed to the Order of High Priesthood. And then it evolved, its name changed during the Nauvoo period to the Holy Order of High Priesthood. Now, if you look at Joseph Smith, during the time he's writing the Book of Mormon and early on in Mormonism, he is always talking about the priesthood. In fact, he doesn't even call it the priesthood. He calls it the Order of Melchizedek, which is the first and earliest name for the Order of High Priesthood. He then starts in Kirtland to start talking about it as the High Priesthood. And then, when we get into the Nauvoo era, as the name again changes, he starts referring to the priesthood and the highest levels of the priesthood as the Holy Order. And if, sorry,
anyways. No, I was just going to point out, and you know, like you're saying, that is very consistent with the Book of Mormon, because a lot of the ideas of the priesthood were developed after the, 1830, but that high priesthood and the Order of Melchizedek is sort of a head scratcher when you look at the other development of his ideas with priesthood. But from what you're saying, it makes perfect sense, because he's really closely riffing on those ideas from Masonry.
Yeah. You know, and this is things that, you know, most Mormons know nothing about. I think it's pretty cool. So
yeah, I mean, I've never heard it laid out in that sort of detail. So I think that's fascinating. And just as you've been going on, you know, in the past while, the language, you know, how many just little ideas just show up here, there, and around. And which, here's your next project I'm assigning you. You need the reference companion. You're going to pull all the all the little references so that we can look them up in a an encyclopedia like book.
Woohoo! Yeah, and I'm actually, you know, creating something like that. So the other thing I want to discuss here is for the Vermont era, is that if you actually look at Universalists, they were interesting. They were very interested in ideas. So one of the things that actually forms the Universalist movement is the writings of rationalists like my mind's going blank here, like Ethan Allen's Reason, the Oracle of Man, and Thomas Paine's Age of Reason. Those are references to those, and discussions of those are all over in Hosea Ballyhoo's ideas. And in fact, the Universalist movement itself was very, very much into kind of the middle path. They didn't want to be the skeptics that rejected Christianity and became deists. But they also didn't want to be the ultra believing people who, you know, just take everything that they're told. And so they were trying to march this middle path. Now, if you actually look at discussions of Masonry, many men were drawn to Masonry for exactly that reason. It was a middle way. It didn't make you a deist, but at the same time, you weren't a fundamentalist believer. Now, the interesting thing is, in Universalism, this later on turns into a big problem, because all of a sudden they start saying, well, there's all these spiritual ideas. We do believe in these, but in order to believe in them, we have to treat them scientifically. You know, how do you get revelation? How do you deal with these type of things? And this is really cool, because a lot of these guys start being interested in phrenology, in seances, and these type of things. And you see this expressed in Joseph Smith Sr. as well. He starts getting into the money digging. He starts, you know, using rods, these kind of pseudo-scientific things that are built and look sciency, but at the same time are tapping into the supernatural.
Well, and I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, the Universalists and the Unitarians emerged later, but the Unitarian movement was very upscale, sort of, you know, a lot of the poets and the philosophers and the writers were Unitarians, but the Universalist movement was earthy. It was more a religion of the people. So that mix between Christianity and masonry and the occult and all that kind of stuff just sort of mixed in, because they weren't as interested in the taxonomy of the ideas.
Right. I've heard it said that Universalist movement was the backwoods hick cousin of Unitarians.
Well,
the other thing here, as I ought to mention, is if you actually read like any of the Masonic commentators from this time period, one of the things that they discuss is that the Masons were very, very into magic. And they were very much into theurgy, the idea of, you know, what is the process of becoming like a god. And both the people within Masonry that are talking about this and the critics themselves are also just making fun of this during the Morgan Affair. And so there's this natural idea within Freemasonry of, yes, we're interested in magic. And this rubs off on Joseph Smith Sr. and his family. In fact, if you actually look at Mother Smith, she writes this very, very interesting thing in her biography. She's trying to defend herself for their magical practices in the New York area. And she says, yeah, we did draw some circles, and we did practice the faculty of Abrac. But, you know, we made sure that we did everything else. The interesting thing here is that phrase, faculty of Abrac, actually comes from a Masonic document called the Leland Manuscript, and it's the only place you get the full phrase faculty of Abrac. And so what she's basically saying there is our family was involved in Masonic magic. Okay? And if you actually look at what books influenced the Smith family's magical practices, one of the biggest books is the writings of Henry Cornelius Agrippa, which was repackaged in the book, The Magus, which is almost completely taken from that. And if you look in Masonic history from the time period, and especially in New York, there's this discussion in Masonic circles that Henry Cornelius Agrippa was actually one of the guys who started Freemasonry in France. And so the Joseph Smith and his brothers, Joseph Smith and, you know, his sons and stuff, who are very much interested in this magic, when they focus in on whose magical text we're going to be reading, we're reading the magical text of a person that we think was a Mason in France and started Masonry in France. So you can see there's these intimate connections between the ideas of the magical practices that, you know, begin in Vermont and then blossom in New York, and that these are all tied in with the Masonic ideas.
And, of course, the birth of Mormonism.
Yes.
Okay, so
that kind of takes us through Vermont. Anything? Where else we want to go?
No, you know, I've mentioned before that it's sort of erroneous. The church, there's sort of this mythology that there's just sort of nothing happening, and then Joseph Smith has the first vision, and then a couple things happen, then the Book of Mormon comes out, and the church is organized, and bam, that's the start, 1830. But of course, the church grew organically out of the beliefs and practices, and the early members would not have seen like 1830 as the start of the church, sort of as we mythologize now. So, but the Book of Mormon is a big, you know, gate that the church hit, that things started changing after there, because it bought a certain amount of legitimacy to these folk doctrines and practices. So,
yeah, most definitely.
I keep coming back to the Book of Mormon because.
Okay, should we get to the Book of Mormon?